As you know, the Dunning Lectures were instituted to promote understanding and appreciation of the supreme importance of the dignity, freedom, and responsibility of the individual person in human society. This year, the Dunning Trust Committee chose the topic of higher education for the Dunning Trust Lectures. Our first speaker in this series of lectures was Dr. Bowden from Manchester. As you recall, Lord Bowden, he introduced the subject from the point of view of Western countries. And when he was here, the committee asked him for a suggestion, a recommendation for someone to speak from the point of view of the non-Western world or the less developed countries. And Lord Bowden recommended to us very strongly Dr. Bafour. And I'm very pleased to report tonight that our invitation to Dr. Bafour was successful, and we're welcoming him here this evening to give us the second lecture, in which he will be examining the subject of higher education from the point of view of the less developed world. Now, Dr. Bafour is a distinguished citizen from Ghana. He was educated, I think, entirely in Ghana, and I believe was the first Ghanaian to receive a degree in engineering. He did all his studies in Ghana, as I understand, Dr. Ford, but his degree was given to him by the University of London. He, upon graduation, he immediately began to use his skills to help the development of his country, and he worked primarily as a civil servant and as a teacher. But in 1960, he left the Ghanaian civil service to assume the post of principal of Kumasi College of Technology. He remained in this post until 1966, during which time the university underwent very substantial development. And in 1966, he returned to the business world, and where he is now the director of his own engineering and industrial firm, carrying on a practice of industrial consulting in Ghana. Dr. Bafour is a member of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers and of the Institution of Nuclear Engineers, a fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society. And during his tenure as principal of the university, he was also chairman of the Ghana Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1963, he became president of the International Atomic Energy Agency. His professional interests include nuclear engineering and technical training. Dr. Kumasi has taken a keen interest in problems of higher education and has taken a leading part in associations of universities, the Commonwealth, in exchanging ideas with other universities and particularly applying this knowledge to the development of higher education in Ghana. Dr. Bafour is extremely well equipped to speak to us on the subject of the problems of higher education in underdeveloped countries, and it's much pleasure that I introduce him to you now. Dr. Bafour.
I consider myself highly honored and privileged to be given the opportunity of speaking in the series Higher Education and Its Effects in the Unwell Community from point of view of a developing country such as Ghana. Developing countries extend to many parts of the world, the globe, and it would be impossible for me to address you on the relative problems of higher education and their connection with developing countries in other parts, in parts of the world unfamiliar to me. And so I'd like, with your permission, to confine myself in this lecture to conditions obtaining in Ghana and in countries with conditions similar to Ghana. Higher education. Yes, we have come to look on higher education in Ghana as an importation, as a new thing brought in from outside, the object of which is meant to improve upon the ability of the recipient of such education to contribute more to the development of the community in which it lives. And this supposes that he must have a background, a foundation on which the higher education program should be based. And this foundation obviously has a lot to do with his history, the history of the community in which he lives, its culture, its values, and all the things that go to make the society to which the educational program is meant to apply. Let me confine myself to Ghana in this particular instance, because I can speak with some degree of authority on the conditions, the background to which higher educational policy may fit in connection with Ghana. The Ghana community, the predominant tribe in Ghana, the Akan, which 80% covers the Ghana territory, have a long history and a very deep tradition of values and cultural values and social order which extends far, far into the era before the Christian era. The Akan kingdoms were closely connected with the Garamantian kingdom, which existed. The Garamantians and the Carians were identified as one body, and they were spread all along the northern borders of the African coast bordering the Mediterranean and unto Tyre and Sidon and the Phoenician era. When Nebuchadnezzar threw the Phoenicians and the Carians out of Tyre and Sidon, they moved out and occupied Carthage, which had turned into a metropolis. And this was mainly due to the cooperation between the Carthaginians and the Carians, and the territory they occupied even after the destruction of Carthage was notably Garamantian. And the culture and the traditions which we have in Ghana today stem from our connections or our links with the Garamantians. And the Ghana Empire, which existed in the Sahara and which was subsequently thrown out by Abu Bakr ibn Umar in the campaigns of 1060 to 1100, was a very stable and a very sound empire based on a social order of long standing. Herodotus mentions in his book his accounts of the travels of the Nasamonians 450 BC, of the five Nasamonian princes who dared out to venture into the Sahara on a westward route across the Sahara, equipping themselves with food and water to last very many months. Eventually were caught by some troglodytes, diminutive little persons, dark, who spoke in sibilance, and taken to a kingdom in the Sahara, the capital of which adjoined a river, a mighty river flowing from west to east, which they called the Nile, which obviously was the Niger. And this kingdom they called the kingdom of Tha Amundo Akana, the moon worshippers of Akana. Obviously, the Akan peoples lived and extended that area, and they influenced the description of the villages and their cultures and systems exactly as they are found in an Akan society today. So you could see that a people with a long-standing tradition, such as the Akans, must have very deep-seated values which they treasure, which form the basis of their existence in the social order. Now, if you are going to improve upon, if you're going to educate people with such a background, you have got to be extremely careful in modeling and scheming your educational program in such a way as would add to the values they possess and not destroy them. This is important. Now, I wouldn't like to give you feature by feature and factor by factor the detailed analysis of the social structure of the Akans. But I'd mention this, that whereas in the Western world your social order is based upon the male, the Akans are matriarchal by structure. That the Akans repose the cultural values of the society on the female, and the female is virtually the head of the state. She is the custodian of all the properties and all the values that pertain to the society. They have to carry all the law, the customs, traditions, the practices, the usages, and the things that go to make for the embellishment of the society. The cultural values are held by the woman. And the woman, symbolized in the queen mother of the state, is the titular head of the state, and she has the right to appoint who should be a king among the royal houses. And you cannot destool him unless you have the approval of the Queen Mother. And these values are passed on from the Queen Mother to all the mothers of the state, and in turn to their children. You're taught the art of good behavior, you're taught to eschew materialism, you're taught to admire the things that embellish the soul, the things that make you feel the feeling of oneness, one with the other, the concern for others, the ability to serve others, and less yourself, to seek other people's interests. All these cultural values are taught and are made compulsory to women to teach their children and to pass it on to their children in turn. These values are treasured most deeply in Akan society. And a man is admired, respected, according to his adherence to these great values. Despite your affluence, your position in society, and your greatness and the wealth that you command, you can be considered as nothing if you don't fulfill the conditions expected of you by the tribe. Now, these values are so strong, and I know, for instance, that some Ghanaians students were sent out to a country in the east, in the Eastern Bloc, And when I paid a visit to that country, 1962-63, to examine for myself, and to see for myself and report to the government the standing of the students and the assimilation of the knowledge there and the general behavior, I was told this most forcibly by all the men of government that your people are most incorrigible. In point of fact, we cannot even impress on them any of the principles of communism that have easily been absorbed and taken by other people. And why is it that your people have got such deep resentment for anything communistic? We said, no, well, you must look at it this way. Your principles are new, but their values are deep. They go very, very deep indeed, the very structure of society and the very depths of them. Appreciate the full values that they have acquired from their predecessors and their family teaching, and therefore they cannot accept yours without further examination. Therefore, you needn't be surprised about it. This, in short, give you just an example of the values of the system of values that pertain in a country society. Therefore, if you are introducing a form of education into a people with such a background, you've got to be extremely careful. Now, education came into Ghana, was introduced by the white man. Although some education system existed, people are taught by their mothers and their fathers. The fathers teach them the military law, military traditions, military systems, and so on, and the mothers teach them the art of good behavior, and so on. These were done in the family environment, in the tribal environment. But schooling, getting children together to teach them, started with the white men. And they were taught to read and write. Obviously, the purpose of this was to enable them to give up their services as clerks and so on. And soon it began to be felt that was not the only thing that the white man wanted. He wanted to be able to use them also in his administrative field. And so slowly it began to dawn on them that education was meant to give you the ability to read and write, to express yourself in English, and to think English, and perhaps to anglicize you. Now, this may be too far-fetched, but I recall Sir James Pope Hennessy's accounts of what he discovered in Sierra Leone when in 1871 he first took office as governor of the West African Dependencies. His report to Lord Kimberley suggested that the African in Sierra Leone who had been educated and trained was not only tribalized, but he was a disgrace unto his community because they were taken to drinks and they were ill-mannered, improperly behaved, and they were different in their outlook and things to the people to whom they belonged. And they thought that education was tending to destroy the society rather than to build it. Now, this was a comment made by Sir Joseph Hennessy in 1871. Now, later in that period, between 1871 and 1880, there was a period of renaissance in Ghana among intellectuals, most of whom had been trained in Europe, that they must eschew everything European. They must put on again, once again, their garb, and they must stop following the white man's way of thinking. They should speak English and write English, but they must think Ghanaian. They must revert to their old traditions. That was the old society, the old movement that called for going back to the Ghanaian tradition. The biggest exponent of this group was John Mensah Saba, who became one of the most brilliant lawyers and administrators and thinkers of the early, the Ghanaian political period. The background on which her education program should be is developed is this. So the Ghanaian has a form of society and value that is deep-seated. Now, from the basis, you have to build on the superstructure an educational program which is aimed at producing the end result. The end result obviously being self-sufficiency, the stability, and good government. These in turn imply political stability, economic stability, and social order. These three things are the objectives of any nation. Now, within the context of a developing country, what do these things mean? The pressure from the West is very great. All the nations of the West are aiming at intense industrialization. Science and applied science is teaching you how to harness the forces of nature, forces of science, how to harness the resources in the country and to turn them over and develop them for the economic advancement, development of the country, of the people. This presupposes that people have got to be got together into industrial communities, such as you have in the West, intense urbanization, gathering people from their various roots together and creating artificial societies, imposing rules and regulations, and making sure that they behave themselves properly while fulfilling the purposes of industry, of industrial life. This, indeed, is the objective of the objective of a developing country. If a country, developing country, is looking around and seeing developed countries and watching on the TVs and in cinemas and seeing, reading from the papers, how you live, obviously aspire to living the same way. They see you in your cars, your TVs, your air conditioners, and so on. Naturally, these are symbols of a developed life. And so the temptation is there that we must also reach that. That we must also, thank you very much indeed, must also reach this sort of level of living. And therefore, they look to education as a means of reaching the same level of standard of living. Yes, not only that, they want their cities developed as yours. And they want to feel that they too can move around in their cars and can tinker around with a car, can manage an airplane, and can do this and can do that, which developing countries do, developed countries do. But is that the answer? Indeed, we are running into serious problems in our country. And the problems are not created by ourselves. They're created by the force of circumstances and the pressures from the developed countries, on the economy, the political life, and social life of the people. The program of higher education as set out in Ghana was meant, in the first instance, to produce graduates for the purpose of manning the civil service, of carrying on the administration of the country, more so than the scientists and technicians, technologists required for manning the technical departments. So for this reason, emphasis was placed on creating a university campus based on the classics and the humanities. And although engineering had been the first graduate institution established in Achimoto School, the new principal of the institution or of the university college would have nothing to do with it. So it was pushed out of the consideration in the formative periods of the university. Now, it wasn't deliberate. It was accidental, in that although there had been the dire need to man the technical departments and to man them with Ghanaian products, it was considered not as urgent an issue as that of continuing with the administration of the country. And so the University of Ghana was established, but without this other consideration of the technical requirements of the country. Subsequently, under pressure, the Kumasi University College of Technology was established, and science and applied science was meant to be developed there. But right from the early beginning, questions were asked. Is it the intention of the College of Technology to produce scientists and applied scientists for the purpose of merely continuing with the running of technical departments like the Public Works Department and the Railways and the Telecommunications Department? Or was it meant that these people should contribute to building, developing the country, not merely routine-minded people, not comprehensivists, but there should be also specialists working out and defining new measures, new methods of improving the systems already obtaining in the country. So there was a move to intensify the training of these institutions in order to provide for specialist training and research. This was a wise move. And this was more in keeping with the aspirations of the government and the thinking of the people, that not only should scientists and applied scientists be trained to man the institutions, but they should be given the opportunity of thinking out the problems in the country and finding solutions to them. Hence the drive to establish research institutions in the country. A natural research council was set up and eventually expanded to be Academy of Sciences with the object of identifying these problems and initiating action towards the active study and investigations. Now this has been going on, and a lot of work and a lot of money has been spent in directing the course of lectures in the institutions of technical education towards active participation in the problems facing the country. Now, what are these problems? May I identify them? We are faced with acute problem of feeding ourselves with resources from our own country. And the problems facing developing countries today are essentially one of finding the foreign currency with which to meet their essential requirements. And the problems have become more accentuated by the factors that are beyond our control, that is the factors governing the price of raw commodities which these developing countries produce. Cocoa price has been falling steadily over the past 5-6 years and is almost at the rock bottom. Therefore, the countries like Ghana and Nigeria, who to some extent depend upon the foreign currency earnings of these raw materials, have every year to revise the development program because the expectation of funds from the sale of raw materials isn't enough to keep them, to maintain the development program. And therefore, they have to curtail time and time again their program and shrink it in order to make it possible for them to live. This is the stage in which most of the developing countries find themselves. Therefore, in circumstances such as this, what do we have to do? We've got to reconsider and reface our whole development needs. Therefore, we must give priorities not to industrialization, but the things that matter most. First of all, we find that we have to import 25 million new CDs, or the equivalent of about 12 million pounds worth of milk and meat every year to feed the people. And what is the reason? Haven't we got land? Haven't we got forest regions? Can't we do something about our own land? Yes, we can. But what are the limiting factors? These limiting factors are the pests that we must control. We are plagued by the tsetse fly, which prevents the active development of any extensive dairy farming. Therefore, every drop of milk that we import into the country must be imported. With what? With foreign currency, which is so very difficult to earn. Right. Therefore, what is the emphasis going to be? If you are going to use any element of higher education in the country, you must aim at agricultural drive in agriculture and a drive on insect pest control. Therefore, your specialists must be trained to tackle problems such as this. Problems associated with irrigation of the plains and with the study of types of grass, of fodder that the cows would live on, and animal breeding techniques. Make sure that the types of cattle you bring in are suitable to the climate and that they develop resistance to some of the diseases that are prevalent, and so on and so forth. This means a lot of hard work in a specific direction. One, to give us the meat we require and the milk that we require. We still import a lot of maize. Why? Because we still have to introduce large-scale, extensive forest farming, because the area is forested very heavily. And the problems of clearing and bushing and stumping forests is a very enormous one, requiring equipment and requiring special study. Therefore, a study in this direction will also enable us to produce the grain and the food that we require to keep ourselves in train. We have to import the cement to build our houses. Therefore, we must direct our attention to finding the types of equivalents of building materials that we can produce locally ourselves as a substitute to concrete and cement that we use. These fields like things like studying the use of sawdust and so on in aggregates for building and so on, and corn husks and rice husks and so on, other materials, the use of laterite mixed with other chemicals that will enable you to build your houses and make them as secure and as strong as you do with the normal cement which you import at great cost. And what is more, the ability to find out what is on your land. Development of resources, of other natural resources, such as the bauxite, the manganese, and the iron ore, and the things that you got in your country. You would want to train your own people to go and look for them, and to consider ways and means of turning them into good use. But there's the dilemma. If you are going to develop your natural resources, and you're going to indulge in the mistakes that the Western world and developed countries have made in intensive industrialization, that is, you're going to bring in your steel mills and so on and so forth, and be bothered with the problems contamination, pollution, and so on. And these are the problems. Now, these are the things that we have to consider. We have to consider ultimately, because as you do these things, you are inviting the very things that you are now wanting to avoid. So this is the dilemma that faces developing countries. And what is more, you would like in order to maintain stability in the state, your education has got to be such that it must add to the values that already exist and add to them, not destroy them. Now, it is strange to say that we are going through very difficult times and we are questioning the very purpose of education, of higher education, in a country such as Ghana. We are questioning it. And the men in the street whose indigenous wisdom is so deep, so profound, and yet so simple, unsophisticated, and yet so clear. He knows his mind. He is in a position, the average man who walks the street is in a position to decide for himself without any outside influence whether a government's action is right or wrong. And invariably, his judgment is correct. Because his ethics are simple, his judgments, his values are simple, and he assesses a situation by the simple analytical principles is whether this thing is straight or is crooked. Is it false or is it true? Is it moral or is it immoral? Is it helpful or is it destructive? These are the issues he weighs in deciding whether a situation is correct or not. Indeed, it is said that there are walking in Ghana so many Solomons in every street. Because indeed, you would not find an Akan go to do something that is wrong without saying to himself, if I do this, I am going to bring dishonor and disgrace to the family to which I belong. And of course, his name is so valuable to him, it's worth millions of pounds. But when these values, so dear to the Ghanaian, are interfered with and upset by the type of higher education that his children receive, then it is time to begin to ask questions. And these questions are being asked. I shall refer to the circumstances which led to the recent upheaval in Ghana. It is my own view. Others may agree with me, I may disagree. But for once, we had a government of intellectuals, men who'd had reached very high standards of education and had acquired experiences outside the country and were in all respects capable men whose decisions can be relied upon to direct the course of the country in the right channels and achieve results, assuming, of course, that they will do the right thing and that they would fulfill the expectations of the people as judged by the standards and the values that they possess. Unfortunately, certain very fundamental and serious mistakes were committed, which excited the people and made the people wonder whether indeed this government of intellectuals possess the mundane, simple, common sense which the ordinary man in his village, in his town, organizes his society. In every home, you have a family head, and that family head has the imposed obligation to ensure that all the citizens and all the people under his control, under his umbrage, are contented, happy, and work together with the will in order to improve upon the lot of the community. This is the obligation of any family head. And he is respected or disrespected according to how he goes about it. Therefore, if a head of the family commits errors and makes mistakes, everybody sees it. And the family's status is judged by the activities of the head of the family. If he's successful, the family improves and the family increases its wealth and influence. If he fails, the family diminishes in stature. So it is. But if, for instance, a government commits blunders and acts in a manner that is contrary to the accepted values of the people, the reaction is immediate. Judgment is passed quickly. And one speaks to the other, What have these people done? What have these people done? Well, as a pattern of concealment, they would not speak openly, but they would speak within the confines of their rooms. But you can be sure that judgment is quick and unanimous. But openly, they would not pass it. And of course, this is typical of oppressed peoples, that the sixth sense of concealment complex enables them to carry on as though they are insensitive to the happenings around them. But indeed, they are. But it is a part of survival, the principle of survival, not to express their disapproval openly. And in time, when the occasion comes, you will discover that people who have been nodding their heads and saying yes, openly now say no. And that no comes from deep down in their soul, whereas all along they have been saying yes. These patterns of behavior are not to be belittled. They are important. Therefore, it means that if a government and the people administrator of the government, the people who have been brought, who have been privileged to run a country, accept the principle that they must go down to look at the people, test the sensitivities, examine their thinking and their ways in order to make sure that their actions are supported by them. They will fail if they don't do that. For instance, I give you an instance. I was associated with the first railway strike in 1937. I was a railway employee. I was the first railway engineer and was apprenticed at the time. The railway workers went on strike over an issue that I think was quite deserving. And they sought my advice. Naturally, they looked up to me. And I didn't come out openly. I went around. We traveled ostensibly all around the line in the middle of the night and met them, discussed, and came back as though I had done nothing. Well, the strike started. I was under obligation to work, and I worked. They saw me working. They did nothing, but they stood down. The strike was successful. And I knew that we were all fighting a cause, and the cause was righteous. Well, this was in the British days. Many strikes took place, some of which, the results of which was most disastrous. Some people were beaten and left for dead, and so many were imprisoned and so on. That, of course, was the method which was used by the then government in power to impose its conditions on the workers, right or wrong. It did happen. Right. Now, we became independent, and the government was opposed to rule the country. There was another strike. And the general impression in the country is this. All along, when a man works in the government department or works whether PWD or clerk and so on, the general language is this. Understanding is that this is a white man's work. And therefore, this white man's work cannot be carried, should not be carried on your heads. You should be dragged along. You drag it, you don't carry it. You don't make it your burden. You drag it, you get as much as you can out of it. This is wrong, obviously. It may be appropriate when the government is a foreign government. But when the government becomes your own, then, of course, the government must begin to think that it is its prime, a matter of prime importance, that it must disabuse the people's minds of this ideology. It must be the first objective of the government to make sure that the people accept the fact that the government is their own, not a foreign government. That they are not the successors to oppressor government, whatever it is. That they are indeed their own people. And this, of course, would be marked by their attitude to the people. Therefore, if a strike occurs, the government should be able to call the people together and say, look, I know trade unionism is very militant, and naturally in developing countries, trade unionists are very militant. And call them in and consult with them and tell them that this indeed is the wrong way to do it. This government is your own, is your property, and if you talk to them and they see reason, they're not going to strike again. But the moment you start bludgeoning them, wielding the big stick, you drive them more and more into the belief that a wrong belief that the government is a foreign government, is a successor to oppressor government. And this ideology of the white man's work still continues. I'm sorry that I'm introducing this, but it nevertheless illustrates some of the point I wish to make. Now, the pattern of higher education that you must introduce into a country certainly is fraught with all sorts of problems. You have got to aim at building on the foundation that exists, because, and this implies that the type of education must aim at giving the opportunity of investigating more fully the nature and the structure of your society, because there are many assumptions. You know these things exist. Why do we have this value? Why do we have this social structure? Why do we have this particular order? Why do we have this particular pattern of behavior? And these require psychological and philosophical study. Therefore, the type of education, higher education that you must have, must aim at finding out more of what we possess in order that the foundation may be full and meaningful. And then, of course, then having done this, and knowing that your collar, the size of your collar, is 13, is 15, and not 13, and that the size of your shoes are 9 and not 7. Therefore, you know what to do, to fit your pattern of life. From this foundation, you can look then at the objective. What do you want?